Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Simon McCorkindale building in beautiful downtown Chesapeake, it's Phantasmo After Dark, with your host, Rob Floyd, and Sayer of the Law, Tony Mercer.
Not to go on all fours, unless she's into that. That is the law.
With that being said, tonight's topic is Island of Lost Souls. So, Tony.
That's all I get?
That's all you get. I gave you Sayer the Law. What more do you want?
Hi, Rob.
Hey. Hey, before we get into this, I guess we should pimp a few things. Phantasmo Cult Cinema Explosion, the wellspring from which this podcast sprung, say that five times real fast, is coming up on our 10th anniversary. Yes, that's 10 years of bringing you double feature cult movie night on the big screen for free at the Chesapeake Central Library in beautiful downtown Chesapeake. Our 10-year anniversary is going to be in April. I believe it's April 5th, the first Friday in April. And in honor of that momentous event, we're going to show the first two movies we ever showed at Phantasmo. That we chosen at Phantasmo. We're going to show Buckaroo Banzai and Logan's Run up on the big screen. Join us, won't you? It's going to be cool.
Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
That's for you, Blanton. And if we didn't mention it, there are snacks and drinks and door prizes, and it's all free. So bring a friend and come out and see us. Also, coming up, something really, really cool that doesn't happen too often, the Williamsburg Film Festival, which will be the next week after this airs, weekend in March, the 5th, 6th, and 7th. On Friday, March 6th at 9:30, I will be interviewing Mr. Dick Warlock, who was Michael Myers in Halloween 2. I'll be interviewing him, and we'll do a Q&A, and then he will give live running commentary while we watch Halloween 2. So how cool is that? You get to see Halloween 2 with Michael Myers telling you all about it during the film.
All shilling stuff aside?
Yes.
That's actually really cool.
Isn't that cool?
It really is.
You won't see that at bigger conventions.
You won't.
And he'll be during the day at the festival. Of course, he'll be in the dealer's room signing autographs. You can get your picture taken and hang out. And the festival is mainly geared towards classic Hollywood and old Westerns. But once in a while, they have something really cool or have a cool guest like Dick Warlock there, who also doubled for Kurt Russell in a lot of movies. He's also a stuntman in addition to an actor. So come on out and see that. Check out the Williamsburg Film Festival Facebook page or website for info on ticket prices and stuff.
As Kurt Russell's stunt double, it was Dick Warlock's job to eat the peanut butter and banana sandwiches in the Elvis movie.
Uh-huh. That's all you get. That's all I got.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I like the sound of
it. No, but you know, hey, you can drop us a line and refute that if you think it's wrong. Where can they drop us a line, Tony?
I refuse. I'm not doing it anymore.
See what you've done to Tony.
I've had enough.
Nobody is sending emails to...
Nobody cares.
To phantasmopod at bean... What is it?
You can't even be bothered to keep track
look,
of the email address.
I manage the Facebook page. You manage the email.
Ooh, one of these jobs is not like the other.
So drop us a line at the Facebook page for Phantasmo After Dark if you like what we're saying, if you can't stand what we're saying, if you think we're wrong, if you think we're right, if you just want to show Tony some love because he's feeling lonely and neglected.
Nobody cares.
Oh,
if anyone could possibly be forced at gunpoint to give a shit, even
two,
a little one.
Or two or three, you know.
Little brown squirt in the drawers.
Okay, I've stopped listening at this point.
Oh, God.
Can we edit that one out?
If you're disgusted right now,
let us know, won't you?
At phantasmopod@gmail.com.
God.
God damn it. Send a complaint to Gmail because I'm disgusting. And report the email address, phantasmopod@gmail.com, for inappropriate content.
Hey, or if you're listening to us on iTunes, which we're now on iTunes, give us a star rating. Because the more star ratings we get, the more likely we'll to turn up on searches and more people will listen.
Yeah, you know, and it was so awesome because last episode, we put that plea out there for the star rating, and all none of you actually clicked a star on iTunes.
Maybe they're just listening through Podbean.
You know, here's the messed up thing is like I totally get it. I listen to podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I don't leave reviews. I don't do star ratings. I don't email any damn buddy.
But this time it's us.
I can't judge you because I'm the same way. But here's the messed up thing. Like, some of our closest friends listen to this podcast habitually. And not even you sons of bitches can be bothered
to
give me a star rating on the iTunes, Craig.
You're somebody's shining star, Tony. Hey, but with all that said, are you good? You get that A system?
I did.
Oh, you did? Okay. Okay,
yeah, I'm good.
You sitting down? Okay, good.
All right, move on.
Now, tonight's topic, Island of Lost Souls, 1932. The first film version of Island of Dr. Moreau.
First talking one.
Oh, the first talking
there
version.
There was a silent.
Was it really?
Two-reeler.
Really?
Yeah. You know why I know that? Wikipedia. I didn't know that either.
Hey, if you think Tony's wrong about that, drop a line. No, we're not getting into that shit again. Okay, so the first talkie, which was pretty damn good, we were talking about earlier. At length, we were talking about earlier. Starring Charles Laughton and Bela Lugosi, believe it or not, which we'll get into in a minute. Hey, I want to ask you, though, because we didn't talk about this earlier. The running time on this thing is 1 hour and 10 minutes. It's not long at all. So go ahead and watch it, folks. It won't take much time. Watch the films we talk about. See for yourselves. It
takes a hell of a lot more time than it does to leave a star rating on iTunes.
He's got you there.
Just saying.
Did it feel like it was quicker than that to you? Did it feel like the movie just kind of flew by?
Yeah, it feels short.
It starts off, it feels like it's starting off slow, but then all of a sudden it's at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's some 60 minutes, there's some 60 minute 40s Universal pictures that feel much, much longer. Yeah. This one, not so much.
Hey, speaking of the Universal connection, though,
yeah,
let's get this in. This was directed by Earl C. Kenton, not a big name. In the director circles of classic horror.
He's a B-movie specialist. He had a long, very prolific career. I think he made like 140 movies or something like that. But
as far as we're concerned,
yeah,
he did Ghost of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, and House of Frankenstein.
None of which are as good as The Island of Lost Souls.
No. They each have their moments, but let's face it, both house movies are pretty much the same movie. But in this, he did do a few things, though. He had some creepy moments.
He did a few things.
You know, a couple things here and there. You know, hey, he was getting paid. Why not? He made Charles Laughton. Of course, I don't know. Maybe Charles Laughton, you know, is just that creepy to begin with.
But, I think he's just that creepy to begin with.
But he was the creepiest damn thing in the movie. I mean, the animal men and the makeups and the few scenes that were supposed to be shocking, which were a little, you know, had a little bit of shock value to them.
I mean, that's a compliment, by the way. I love Charles Laughton.
Oh, yeah. He made you just feel skeezy when he had those close-ups in the camera and that creepy grin and, you know, like he was going to offer you candy or something or a ride in his van. You know?
No, Charles Laughton, no.
Charles Laughton, who was actually married to Elsa Lanchester, which figures back into the Universal connection.
Well, there's a lot of little connective tissue in this film. Connective tissue that connects it to other episodes of Phantasma After Dark, as a matter of fact.
That's true. Would you like to give us some examples of that?
I would like to give you an example. Well, here's a very easy one. Of course, this is a Paramount picture, just like an early horror Paramount picture, just like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which we talked about last time.
The previous episode.
Now, there's a little confusion around that because Universal actually bought the distribution rights to this picture in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been released under the Universal banner. And as a matter of fact, even the latest Criterion DVD Blu-ray releases have the Universal bumper at the beginning of it. But it is, in fact, a Paramount picture. Anyhow, another thing that it has in common, a more important thing that it has in common with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, is that they share a cinematographer and one Carl Struss.
Oh, okay.
Yes. We talked about...
Well, that would explain why it's such a good-looking picture, as you were saying earlier.
Indeed, and we mentioned briefly, a good-looking picture, as I was saying earlier in the first take of this episode
that we
had to destroy because it was so bloody awful.
We were talking, hanging out in the lounge earlier.
Yeah, so anyhow, we mentioned in the last episode how Frederick March was in DeMille's Sign of the Cross, as was Charles Laughton.
Charles Laughton.
As Nero.
Oh, okay. Right.
Yes.
Like I've seen it. Yes.
And in the Spider Baby episode, we discussed both the old Dark House movie tradition and the movie The Old Dark House, which, in fact, co-stars one, Charles Laughton. There we go.
Well, there you go. There's the connection.
I hope someone out there found that interesting.
I did.
I'm glad that you did. We do this for ourselves.
I might even drop you a line on the Facebook page and let you know it. Show Tony some love. Come on. Come on. You're not seeing what I'm seeing. A shell of a man over here. Really. Look out for a brother, yo. Now,
in the old days, we had a little thing called vaudeville.
Give me a C, a bouncy C.
I don't know why I felt that was necessary. But when you said shell of a man, instead of seeing like, you know, dejected, emaciated me, I imagine little old, suddenly Jewish me. The songwriter and vaudevillian.
With a big cigar and a hunchback and a striped suit.
A birthday comes, but once a year. Sorry, folks.
Da, 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 dee, 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 whatever the hell else you want.
Island of Lost Souls is a good movie, and and we liked it because Charles Laughton and Carl Strauss cinematography.
Yeah.
And it's good.
Well, and now, Lugosi. Okay, we gotta talk about Lugosi, because everybody loves Bela.
Is he in this picture?
He's in this picture. Barely know it, though.
Under all the yak hair.
Yeah, a lot of yak hair. I think they used all the yak hair in California to make this picture.
Yak country is yak California.
Country. Yak country. But the makeup, there were a few that were kind of standouts that really, you know, had an animal look, but there were a lot of them where they just glued yak hair in different places on them. And the makeup, incidentally, was done by Wally Westmore and Charles Gamora, both uncredited in the film. Charlie Gamora was all over Hollywood. A lot of, back then, if you saw a gorilla in a movie, more than likely it was Charlie Gamora in the gorilla suit. He was like the go-to gorilla guy back then. And, of course, Wally Westmore is the Westmores of makeup fame, who did tons of stuff throughout this era up through to today. The show Face Off, if you watch it. Isn't that the name of the show? The makeup show? Anyway, regardless of that.
Someday we'll have to do Creature from the Black Lagoon so that we can talk about...
Bud with his suit and his paintbrush. Yeah. And we got some straight info on that
That's what I'm saying.
Right from Ben Chapman.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, we'll talk about that another time. That'll be, yeah.
There's a teaser for a future episode.
Woo-hoo. But what I was getting at is Lugosi, okay?
Yak hair.
Yak hair. 31, Dracula. Okay, no yak hair. 31, Frankenstein. He got offered Frankenstein before Karloff, turned it down because he didn't want to wear all that makeup so people wouldn't see his face, and he had no lines. Here it is, 32, just 1 year later, and he takes this role in Island of Lost Souls as Sayer of the Law, face completely obscured by tons of yak hair, more than the Wolfman, and he only has a few lines at a few, you know, key moments in the film. A year later, he decides to take a role that he pretty much kind of he turned down for the same reasons he turned down Frankenstein. You were saying something about that, about he was having, you thought he might have been having money troubles by this point?
Yeah, I seem to remember reading that he was having some money trouble at this point, and that's why he was taking these kinds of roles for not very much pay.
See, I didn't know it happened this early on. I thought it was later on that he started to have, I mean, just within a year of Dracula?
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to remember that White Zombie's 31 too, right?
I don't know. Maybe somebody out there could tell us. They could drop us a line or drop us an email and let us know.
So you know, that whole thing with Frankenstein, I guess that had to have been just right super hot on the heels of the release of Dracula when Bela still had high hopes that that would launch him into starring roles in Hollywood. But I think that he was pretty quick to find out how that wasn't going to pan out. I mean, I think... we fans look at him as a big star, and he was still getting, you know, good billing in horror pictures, you know, in the early 30s at this time, for sure. I mean, he still had marquee value for that, but, you know, Dracula didn't translate into a whole bunch of leading, romantic leading man roles, which I think is really, which is what he really expected.
Yeah.
Because that's what he had been doing back home.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I think he really expected to parlay that into something similar here. I don't think, you know, he set out on a horror star trajectory. That's just kind of what happened. So,
well, he always talks about in the interviews about how Dracula is a romantic picture, you know, and the romance of it, and less of the horror aspect of it.
And you know, he made some solid to excellent, depending on which one we're talking about, pictures for Universal in the early 30s after Dracula, with top-ish billing, you know, sharing it with Karloff, who would get the very
Karloff?
Top most of the time. Again, made some good pictures there, but
definitely.
But consider how many of them there were, relative, yeah. you know, compared to how many jobs per year a working actor, particularly a studio employed working actor, would have made in that time.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't become hard to imagine why he might start having to take less prestigious roles for a little less cash.
Can't have a car payment due.
Get a paycheck a little more often.
Yeah.
That's my speculation.
All right. All right. I'll go with that. If anybody else out there has any...
Let's no. Okay, let's be done with that now.
That, I'm just doing that for you, you know?
In 1932... I took a walk on pot in the...
Oh, Jesus. With that being said, we were saying how this is a good-looking picture, and the cinematographer was the same as Jekyll and Hyde. Now, you think that's more the cinematographer? Because we know Earl C. Kenton, and we know his work in the other films.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough call. I mean, I would have to study Kenton's work a little more than I have to be able to. I mean, my inclination is to credit Struss.
Yeah, well, I think it feels more like Jekyll and Hyde, and not by theme or anything, but just the feel of the movie than it does any Universal movie at all. You know what I mean?
It just in terms of the
look and the, I guess maybe the
intangibles. You know what I what yeah. I, what you would sort of call the atmosphere for yeah. lack of a better
atmosphere.
Way
there you go. It. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the lighting in this thing is awesome. I mean,
oh, yeah.
When I talk about the look of it is all down to the lighting. And, you know, Struss uses, and, you know, again, see how quick I am to credit Struss here. Here's one of those words that you read a lot but never have to say. Chiaroscuro, is that the proper pronunciation?
I don't think so.
Okay, well.
But I know what you're trying to say, but I'm not even going to try to pronounce it.
Chiaroscuro.
Hey, if anybody out there knows how to pronounce
it. Stop it.
Come on, that was a perfect opportunity.
I'll find a soundbite of somebody pronouncing it correctly.
Anyway, I know what you're saying.
Lighting, that kind of lighting.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about. Look it up.
Well, he makes Lawton look creepier than shit.
Yeah.
You know, every time, especially when he has those close-ups and he has that smarmy grin and that low lighting on
him. You notice the cage motif in the lighting? How, you know, I mean, there's cages, obviously, on the compound. So there's cages, you know, in frame, and then they're near cages. But even when they're not, the shadows put bars over the characters. You know, I want to say when they're indoors almost all the time, there's some kind of bar or cage.
Yeah. Symbolic
image
cage.
In the lighting being, you know, half covering the characters and things like
that. So everybody's in a cage.
Right.
Yeah, that's
and of course,
cool.
You know, who's the animal and who's the man and who's in the zoo and who's on the outside and all that kind of thing.
The deeper philosophical meaning that H.G. Wells wishes was in the film.
Might very well be present in the lighting.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I'd have to, again, study Kenton's oeuvre. There's one I know how to pronounce. A little more closely to be able to say for sure. But my inclination is to credit Struss. You know, and it's an interesting thing because one of the arguments, interesting to me anyway, one of the arguments against the auteur theory in the days when it was new is that movies in the studio era were made on an assembly line, and you had just a small army of technicians and artisans that were all sort of contributing to a baseline standard of quality from studio to studio, and that you can't, you know, credit the director too much with all aspects of a movie. So I don't buy into that as a counter argument, but there is a point to be made there that with you know, when you're trying to identify an auteur or a director who is the author of a film, what you're looking for are themes and motifs that are repeated, present, and identifiable in that person's work over and over again. So if you look at Ghost of Frankenstein, is one of the least distinguished, if not the least distinguished to me, movie in that series. But it's not incompetent. And House of Frankenstein is a pretty decent looking
movie.
Not in the way that something like An Island of Lost Souls is. Not in that style.
No.
You know, it doesn't have much to say visually. But it's a slick looking movie. And I think if there's and then if you look at House of Dracula, it's not as good looking of a movie as it to me as House of Frankenstein, and maybe not even as good a looking a movie as Ghost. But what's interesting is that all three of them look quite different.
Yeah. Directed by the same guy.
All directed by the same guy.
But different cinematographers.
Right. So, you know, here we have sort of the manifestation of what I was talking about.
Yeah.
With the studio assembly line, and you had a lot of sort of talented
that's
people
a great example,
working together, but you don't have an organizing principle, you know, with the director sort of bringing it all in together and into one recognizable. Hopefully somewhere in all there was a good point.
No, I was with you. That's a great,
I think
a great
I started,
example.
I started on one foot and ended on the other, but I think I got something across.
No, but that's perfect, though, because especially those, you know, you take these four movies, all directed by the same guy, and they all look completely different. You know, like I said, they're not bad looking. Ghost, the least of distinguishable.
Yeah.
House of, what you said, Frankenstein was a better looking than Dracula, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Those two kind of run together in my head a lot of times.
I would say House of Dracula is a more interesting in some ways looking movie than Ghost of Frankenstein, which is very bland to me. But I would say Ghost of Frankenstein is a little slicker and looks like it had a little bit more money spent on it than House of Dracula did. But the key point again there is that none of them really look the same, and nor do they, other than the plot similarities between some of them, nor do they have any kind of repeated themes that you go, oh yes, you know,
yeah,
I see Kenton's at it again, boy, you know, that's not, you know, like getting back to the auteur theory thing, like the studio era directors that, you know, the auteurists return to again and again, Hitchcock and Hawks,
mm-hmm,
and Ford, and these guys who worked in the studios and they worked with, you know, different folks on the technical staff, you know, all through the years and for a long time, but you know one of their movies every time you see it. You know it visually, you know it thematically, it's identifiably their own. So nothing that I've seen from Kenton, which only is a little bit of his non-horror work, I have to say, mm-hmm, suggests it is unfair to give Struss quite a bit of credit for for how great Island of Lost Souls look. But who knows?
Yeah. Well, like you say, I mean, he just makes a movie that could be a boring film, depending on how it was handled. Because it feels like it starts off kind of slow. I might have said this earlier, but all of a sudden you feel like it's at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Stuff's starting to really go down and happen. But throughout that, like you said, it's got this great lighting, and even when you're not paying attention to it, it's there. You go back and watch it. If you've seen it before and haven't seen it recently, go back and watch it now, after some of the stuff we've said here, and pay attention to the lighting in it. It's really more than it gets credit for, I think. I got to say, I want to say I enjoyed Jekyll and Hyde more as overall as a film, because it surprised me, like we talked about in that podcast. But this, I didn't enjoy any less. I still did enjoy this film. And the thing that stuck with me from the first time I watched it to now and still works is how creepy Charles Laughton is in it.
Yeah.
And the lighting on it makes him look even creepier in a lot of scenes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it is a creepy is the right word. It's a creepy movie. It has a dreamlike atmosphere.
Yeah.
The Beastmen and the sounds they make, and you know, Charles Laughton sort of leering and rolling his eyes like he does, and you know, the extreme close ups with, you know, people sort of running up to the camera, or the Beastmen running up to the camera,
and the people playing to the camera in the close ups.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of that going on in it, which kind of gives it like you're dreaming.
Yeah.
Like you are seeing what's going on,
right?
Because they're playing right to you.
Yeah.
And another thing that, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'll get this in before I forget, that you said the dreamlike atmosphere, I think that adds to that is the lack of incidental music throughout the entire film, and the lack of sound in a lot of spaces. I didn't notice it. It took me a while to catch on. When people are walking or running through the jungle, you don't hear their footfalls. You don't hear them brushing branches. It's really silent until they speak, or till there's like maybe a confrontation, they start wrestling around or something, then you hear some stuff moving around. But it's really odd. There's no Foley going on, hardly at all. They open a door and stuff like that. You don't hear all the time that background noise that you should hear. And it gives it more of that kind of, like you say, like a dreamlike quality to it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but but it works, you know? And I interrupted you, and you lost your train of thought, didn't you?
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Okay, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's quite all right.
You just hit it when you said dreamlike. I didn't think of that before.
Yeah.
But I think that's what I was trying to say about the lack of sound was that's, you know, and you hit the nail on the head.
Well, I don't know what I was going to say before, but what I thought about when you were talking about the lack of sound is you talked a little bit about that, about the lack of incidental music for Jekyll and Hyde. And each time that comes up, it makes me want to go off on a tangent about Frankenstein versus Bride of Frankenstein. But I'm not going to do it. We got to save it.
That'll be another one.
For its own.
Yeah.
I'll tease that a little bit, too.
It'll be a podcast of gods and monsters.
I'll tease a future episode of Phantasma After Dark and tell you that Rob and Kim and I did our own amateur shot-by-shot analysis of Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. And we came up with a definitive conclusion of our own, anyway, about the age-old, you know, which one is better.
The
is Bride
debate.
Really a better movie than Frankenstein? And if you want that answer... You will find out on a future episode of Fantastic.
Somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, we were talking about the way this is shot. There's actually a couple chilling scenes. There's a couple, you know, for the time, anyway. Today, most of it's quite tame, but a couple of shocking scenes that I'm sure were, you know, the scenes that were cut out. Because when it first came out in 1932, it was banned in England, in the UK, and didn't get passed till 1958. And in that, even then, it was an extremely cut version. But the scene where they, you know, somebody bursts into the lab and they're dissecting one of the animen while he's alive.
Vivisection.
A vivisection right there on the table. And that's pretty creepy when you realize what's going on.
Yeah.
And the screams of pain in the house of pain. And then, you know, a couple of the other jolts when you see the animen. I like saying animen. you know, like right there.
So vivisection is the act of cutting a creature open while it's alive to see how its internal workings work. It's a very, very disturbing idea. It's something that was actually done, you know, in the day in the name of science. And that was a one of the themes of Wells's original story, Island of Dr. Moreau, was a sort of an anti-vivisectionist slant. But Moreau creates, or he takes, what he does is he takes animals, if you haven't seen the movie or read the book before, he takes animals and he vivisects them, and then he, through surgical means, begins to rearrange their parts and pieces.
And advance evolution,
right,
as he says in the film.
To see if he can turn beasts into men.
And he succeeds smashingly on, especially with the Panther Woman.
Lota the Panther Woman.
Ah, Lota the Panther Woman. Hey, and speaking of that, we were talking too before about the different versions of this film that have been made over the years.
Right.
And you know, we brought up the Marlon Brando version, which we don't really need to talk much about that. And the Burt Lancaster, Michael York's was a 77, Barbara Carrera, and Richard Basehart, Sayer of the Law, which was, you know, it wasn't a bad film. It wasn't this film.
No, well,
it wasn't moody like this.
I was a kid, I loved that film.
You know,
I saw it on Chamber Theater here locally, which used to run, I think, Friday nights. And
Channel 3, wasn't it?
I want to say it was 13.
Was it?
Okay. I could be wrong.
It was the Chamber Keeper, Rick Clark.
Right.
Yeah.
Mr.
Nice fella.
Yo, very, very nice cat. Yeah, he's graced us with his presence at Monster Fest on a few occasions.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to thank him for the good times when I was
cool.
An 11, 12-year-old lad watching this show late on Friday nights, if I recall that correctly. Anyhow, yeah, Chamber Theater, they had a package which was riddled with a lot of 70s American International product. Because I do remember seeing seeing the 77 Moreau and Empire of the Ants and Food of the Gods and all that stuff on there for the first time.
The Gortner.
Right. So yes, as a kid, I really dug the Michael York, Burt Lancaster, I can't remember who directed it, version of Moreau. Finally, you know, bought it on videotape when I found it as an adult, and I hadn't seen it since then, and I was so excited, and I watched it, and did not find that I enjoyed it as much later in life as I did. Now, actually, it's coming out. It's coming out on Blu-ray sometime this year.
Oh,
yeah. So, I mean, I think when the videotape I watched, you know, obviously pan and scan, and I think it was like an EP Good Times video copy or something like that. So,
yeah, I've had a few of those.
I'll probably get the Blu-ray when it comes out and give it a spin and see if a better presentation helps it out.
Yeah.
Because I mean, come on, Michael York and Burt Lancaster and Barbara Carrera.
Yeah. Well, and here's another interesting tidbit. And Richard Basehart is Sarah of the Law. You know, we watched Crimson Pirate a while back.
Yeah.
Okay, Burt Lancaster and his partner, Nick Cravat, the mute, and they did the acrobatics and stuff, who was actually, like, Burt Lancaster's one of his closest friends. They even worked out in between movies and did stuff. And Nick Cravat is in that movie as one of the Beast Men, too. I'm not sure which one, but, you know, they're friends until the end.
There you go.
If you haven't seen The Crimson Pirate, great Burt Lancaster film. Check it out.
So, Moreau stuck in my head. 11 or 12, whatever I was, chamber theater. And then later I would seek out and begin to read all of Wells' novels, or novelettes, as they were.
Oh.
Largely because of Moreau. I mean, that was actually the first one
I read
before Time Machine, before War of the Worlds, before
any of them.
Yeah. So I always had a strong affection for that story. And Lost Souls was one that I read about, you know, as another cinematic adaptation of that story that's out there somewhere.
Yeah.
And put on a list to track down and see, and didn't get to see for a long time. I mean, the first time I finally saw that was on that Universal Monster Collection VHS tape that they released of it, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah, it had the nice artwork on his box. Right. I had that copy, yeah.
It
was the first time I saw it, too, was on that.
Maybe 92 or something like that is when I finally got a chance to see it. Yeah. And there's a lot of folks other than me, meaning in addition to me, but I'm meaning I am not one of these folks who have this sort of nostalgia for the VHS era.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And some that even argue that, you know, the fuzzy, obscured image somehow enhances the atmosphere. Sorry, Dan. I just can't get behind that. But I couldn't possibly disagree with that more in most cases. But I will say,
yeah,
there's something about the low-res presentation of the Beastmen scenes on VHS back in those days that stuck in my head. And while I do definitely appreciate the new fancy Blu-ray from Criterion and consider it superior and wouldn't trade it for the VHS, I'll always kind of remember what those fuzzy
man.
Blown out. I'm cutting that whole thing. Forget all that. That's coming out. Was there a point to that? Fuzzy
I
have
no
man?
Idea. I was trying to go with you on
too
that one.
Crickets.
I don't know.
All right.
But hey, you know, you're talking about the other versions of the film.
Yeah.
How many people out there, I wonder, have seen a film called The Twilight People from 1972?
Not I.
Which was made in the Philippines. And it was originally was going to be a Corman picture. And I forget all that I read about it now. But it is a modern take on Lost Souls or Dr. Moreau. And I believe it starred John Ashley and Pam Grier as the Panther Woman.
Gotta see if we can. Gotta see if we can hunt that down.
Oh, we gotta hunt it down. And another person that's in it.
Yeah,
Jan Merlin.
Wow,
who my dad is friends with. So, you know, I may have to get him on the phone at some point and get the straight poop on that one if he can remembers anything about that film. That cat has done a lot of films over the years, but it'd be really cool if he remembers anything about that and working with Pam Grier.
Yeah, well, that I think is like a Eddie Romero project, right, from the Philippines.
Could have been. I think the story was funding fell through or whatever, but Corman was supposed to make it, and something about that fell through, so John Ashley or somebody, Romero, is that what he said?
Eddie Romero.
Just took it and decided they were going to make it and finished it or something.
If you want to know more about Eddie Romero and the Corman pictures made in the Philippines and a lot of genre pictures made in the Philippines in the 70s, there's this cool documentary. I think it's still on Netflix.
Oh, yeah, it is.
What is it? Machete Maidens.
Machete Maidens, yeah. That's fantastic.
Is there more to the title, or is it just Machete Maidens?
I think it's just Machete Maidens, yeah.
I don't think they talk about the Twilight people in it.
No, I'd remember that.
Because I think it's focused more on the
the women in prison.
The Corman stuff.
Yeah.
But it does talk about who Eddie Romero is and some of the other things that he did. But it's a great, it's a fantastic documentary. You should watch it anyway. So, boy,
yes,
we are off track. So
that's our thing. That's our shtick. But you know, we went into how it was banned in the UK.
Yeah,
did and we? Yeah, I think we did at one time.
This is our second attempt to do.
Oh,
this,
okay. No, so. Edit that out. But like I said, it was banned in the UK when it came out in 1932 and didn't get passed until 1958. And after, you know, after a lot of cuts in the film, and even then it got an X certificate. It didn't get a PG rating until 2011 with the scenes put back in. And I think you were saying how it, which is true, in the UK, you think we had censorship on films here. Man, the video nasties in the UK. Try to find a copy back in the 70s or the 80s of Texas Chainsaw or anything like that.
Yeah.
It was nuts. But with that being said, I've said that about a million times trying to segue back into the topic.
So what do you think of Richard Arlen in this picture?
What, the lead guy?
Yeah, yeah. The romantic lead.
Not a lot. I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way. He didn't stand out to me.
Yeah.
You know? He was kind of bland, maybe kind of wooden. Didn't have a lot of charisma.
Yeah. So in other words, the part of David Manners will be played by Richard Arlen in this picture. Yeah, that's a problem that you get a lot with these, I think, all through the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
Is if you need a handsome, square-jawed hero or a romantic leading young man, I had a hard time finding ones with a charisma to do these horror pictures a lot of the times in those days, it seemed like.
Yeah, which was odd because, you know, I mean, you got Charles Laughton. You know, and who was a name by that point?
No, I mean, he's a star of the show. I mean,
yeah.
And still, you would think, though, that you'd want someone.
A counterbalance. You know, and it's just not there with this guy.
But I remember hearing that Randolph Scott was originally considered for the role.
Oh, wow.
And while I'm not the greatest fan of Richard Arlen, preferable to Randolph Scott. I'm not. Randolph Scott should stick to Westerns. It's, I don't know why it is that producers felt it necessary to start sticking Randolph Scott into Fred and Ginger movies, but I cringe every time he shows up on screen. It's like,
man.
I'm cutting that, too.
Okay, you can cut that.
I've insulted Richard Randolph Scott.
You wouldn't say that to Randolph Scott. And scene. Okay, so, hey, did you notice, I know you did notice, because I pointed out to you when it was on, actually playing on the big screen over there a few minutes ago, the scene where the Beastmen are actually coming into and taking over
the compound.
They're storming the castle, and they've got torches, and they're yelling and screaming, and as they're getting to the gate, and they're trying to knock down the door, one of the torches gets a little too close to some of the yak hair and lights one of the guys' heads on fire. And if you see real quick, just before they cut away, the one right behind him like puts his hand up like he's trying to put it out.
Yep, yep. That's awesome.
It's like the stormtrooper bumping his head on the door.
Yep.
But it's still in there. I mean, they didn't edit that whole thing out and get him to do it again. You know, so that was a little something to watch out for, folks.
Not to set the hair on fire.
What is the law?
That is the law.
But, you know, it's actually the whole scene at the end there where they are taking over the Moreau, the compound, and taking Moreau into the House of Pain. Pretty damn chilling.
Yeah.
And when they bust through the cabinet and get the surgical instruments and you see the hands come up, they're starting to all at once start to stab him and kill him and just all the screaming and stuff. It's pretty effective. It's pretty much the money shot of the film. It's pretty creepy. Be advised, like I said before, there is no incidental music like in Dracula and in Jekyll and Hyde. I think Jekyll and Hyde's an easier watch, though. It seems to flow.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about this. It's very good. Island of Lost Souls.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not knocking it.
It falls short of great.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
There are elements of it that are great.
Yeah.
And it's so worth your time if you're into this sort of thing. But it's not really more than the sum of its parts. But it's got great parts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You got to be in the mood to see it. Because if you're not in the mood, if you're just putting it on just to have something on, you're going to lose interest in it. Because like you say, there's great parts. But in between those great parts, there's, you know, you got to pay attention to it to enjoy it.
Well, so it's, in fairness, I think there's truth to that in any film that goes for that dreamlike atmosphere.
Yeah, okay. Uh-huh.
You got to be ready to get into that groove.
Yeah,
you know? And if you're not, it's not going to work.
No matter how good it is, you're just not going
to,
yeah.
No, you got to be ready to succumb to that, I think. It's missing something. The unengaging lead in Richard Arlen.
That's probably the biggest part of it.
Doesn't help, yeah.
It's because you're waiting for Lawton to get back on screen for something to right. happen. I mean, because there's no chemistry between the Panther Woman and the lead.
Yeah.
Because Lawton puts them together to see something happen.
Right.
And nothing, the audience doesn't see that happen either. Yeah.
And I think giving Richard Arlen a beautiful blonde love interest from back home that manages to show up on the island.
Yeah.
I think that was a mistake.
And, yeah.
You know, that's a concession to convention that waters the movie down some. And I think it's not necessarily that I'm suggesting that, you know, we should have had on-screen sex between Richard Arlen and Lota the Panther Woman.
Couldn't have hurt.
But I'm saying there's some interesting places that it could have gone where it can't with Blondie in there, you know, and some things it could have focused on.
It struck me as odd when she came to the island. It kind of tilted the picture a little bit, you know? Right.
Yeah, because he really needs to be there on his own with no help,
you know,
sort of making his own... Not only finding his way out of the quandary on his own, but dealing with the sort of the moral morass that environment presents on his own.
Well, you know, when she gets there and then the boat captain, who's kind of comic relief, it comes out of the dreamlike quality when they're on screen.
Yeah.
And when the scenes with Arlen.
Yeah.
Arlen?
Well, Richard Arlen is the actor's name.
Yeah.
They changed the character's name from the book, so I can't never remember what they call him in the movie.
But, it comes out of that, and I don't want to say halts, but it almost changes. It's a different film for a couple minutes.
Yeah.
You know, when you're just kind of getting settled into it. Maybe that's one of the things that kind of, I was talking about, you got to be in the mood to watch it. Maybe that's what kind of takes you out of it.
Yeah.
Is kind of like a speed bump, kind of a stumbling block. It changes. Man, I'm going to have to go back and watch it again now. See, we even learn stuff doing this. This is like personal therapy sessions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't really get the easy, obvious out that she presents, plus the running time, plus the fact that you don't really get a sense of. Well, you know, in the book, there's a stretch of it where, to some extent, our lead is resigned to his fate being there on the island. You know, where he's just kind of dealing with, even after he knows what's really going on and he's seen it, he's stuck there for a good while.
Yeah,
without a plan for getting out, really. You know,
okay,
and just sort of learning to cope with it, and it speaks to that whole banality of evil thing. You know,
yeah,
and there's some real, I hesitate to call it temptation, you know, but sort of a moral quandary there for him to deal with, other than simply the revulsion of what Moreau is up to and all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
and you don't get any sense of that in this, because you just can't, because of the way that it's presented. And I don't know that I want to really put all that off on the time. Especially now in this pre-code era, especially when you look at what Mamoulian managed to achieve with Jekyll and Hyde, which we talked about.
Oh yeah,
I don't want to give it the easy out and say, well, it was the time, and you know, they couldn't really go there in the movies at that time.
Yeah,
and now that we've talked about this and thought about it, I kind of have more sympathy for Welles's take on the movie that he didn't like it because it went
for a straight horror picture.
It was more concerned with the horror element, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. More concerned with the horror than it was with his philosophical ideas.
And it was only an hour and 10 minutes, too.
Right.
It was a really short film. But, you know, you brought the pre-code era, too. Now, this was still in the pre-code era, and that was one of the reasons, I guess, later you didn't see it show up as much, or it was in cut versions later on. But one of the key things, beside the vivisection scene, but one of the key things in this one, I can't remember if we brought this up already, is the line... Similar to the line in Frankenstein, where Moreau turns to Arlen and says, "Do you know what it feels like to be God, or do you know what it means to feel like God?"
Right,
is the line. Yeah, that wasn't a well liked line by the censors, and that was cut out for a long time. And you didn't hear anything like that in films, you know, throughout this era. Or you did, but it was cut.
Well, a lot of the censorship was driven by the religious special interests. Yeah, so.
Comparing a man to be like God was a no-no.
Yeah.
Even more shocking than a glimpse of thigh or side boob, like a Jekyll and Hyde. There you go. Okay. You're talking about Charles Laughton is pretty much the only one in the film, I think, that has any kind of charisma. Would you agree? I mean, even the Panther Woman, she's kind of blah. I mean, she doesn't have any... She's not bad looking, but there's just nothing coming off of
her. No, no, no. Well, she's not... She's not. She wasn't an actor.
Yeah.
You know, if I remember correctly, they just sort of found her almost on the street somewhere, and she never did another picture after that.
Yeah, but that character is supposed to be very sexual, very sensual. As far as the... I don't know in the book, but as far as the picture goes, and in other versions of the movie,
yeah,
they play that up a lot, because he's supposed to be attracted to her, and Moreau is trying to see if she is attracted like a woman to a man.
Right.
Since she was evolved from a panther.
Right.
You know? But this chick just doesn't have any... No charisma. There's no spark between the two of them.
Right.
The doctor... Well, you kind of feel a little sorry for the vet doctor that working with Moreau.
Yeah.
I think he comes across well. Other than that, his fiance that shows up, the blonde, she's pretty, but she doesn't bring anything to the show.
Right.
I think the drunken boat captain at the beginning, and then the boat captain that brings her there, the comic relief, they're too brief in the film, but they're the only other two, I think, that stand out, really, you know? Right. Even Lugosi, I mean, he only has a couple of lines, a couple of parts, and like we were saying, he's completely covered that you barely would recognize him unless he speaks. So Charles Laughton is carrying the picture. I mean, I would say. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think what we're really talking about here is really just a lot of conventional lower budget movie stuff. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, do you think the picture it would have risen above that if it had a few more faces in it?
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say is, you know, we talked about with Jekyll and Hyde how it was essentially an A picture. It had a director on it and, you know, significant stars.
Yeah.
And they spent good money on it and things like that. I wish I had done some research on Lost Soul specific to this before we recorded, because then I could speak to this from a place of knowledge instead of speculation. But I don't think that wasn't the intention, or I wonder if that was the intention with Lost Souls, if what they were really doing was trying to create a horror programmer to cash in on the boom, which doesn't really seem like what they were trying to do with Jekyll and Hyde.
No.
I wonder if that's very much... Because the things that we're more... I don't want to say complaining about, but the things that we're pointing to are things that you could say about it. A great many horror programmers, low-budget horror programmers of the era, you know.
But this seems like it's like you said before, it's good, but it's not great.
Yeah, but a telling thing, though, is that they put... I mean, Kenton was, like I said, a B-movie specialist and had been for a long time before this, because he, you know, worked through The Silence prolifically. You know?
Oh, okay.
So the fact that Paramount assigned Kenton to this picture certainly suggests that there's some merit to what I'm saying about, you know, this wasn't really looked at as a high-profile project necessarily.
Yeah.
Could be wrong. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But there's a possibility of that, and if that's the case, well, that's why they didn't necessarily give it more star power than they did. Laughton, I don't think. Let's see, what year was Sign of the Cross?
Oh, geez, you got me.
Has he done that yet at this point?
I think so. I don't know.
I think so.
That's on my list. I need to see that one.
Anyway, I think I've made whatever point there's worth making here with that. But what I'm trying to say.
Well, let's play a game, okay? Let's play the age-old game that all movie buffs do with movies from time to time, which I think we have yet to do at all here on the old podcast. Who would you cast? Who do you think from that time could have brought it up in the other part? I mean, Charles Laughton is there. He's Moreau. But say as the lead or as the other doctor that's helping Moreau.
Oh, that's a good question.
Karloff is the other doctor?
No.
How would you like to see that, Karloff?
No. For me, I mean, unless they put him in like a non-speaking makeup role, like an old Dark House or whatever, it never quite works for me when they put Karloff in supporting roles like that. He's such a distinctive presence.
He's too big for a supporting role.
He really is. Yeah. So that doesn't work at all.
But just an example, you know. Yeah. So
I don't know. I off the top of my head, I can't come up with anything. I'd have to think about that for a while.
Yeah.
But how about you?
I don't know. That's why I was asking you.
We have both failed at what Rob has described.
Miriam Hopkins is a Panther Woman.
Hey, Miriam Hopkins is Lota.
I'd like to see her in a dark black wig and acting out the Panther Woman.
Well, honestly, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's tough to say. You know, purely as a visual, I got to go back to another Sign of the Cross co-star and say Claudette.
Oh, well,
make a hell of a Panther woman. But as a performance, though, that feels somehow beneath Claudette, really. I think something more would have to be done with the role itself for me to want to see Claudette.
Okay, for our lead, David Manners.
We've effectively already got David Manners.
not David Manners. Let's see. Who else do we have? John Agar. John Agar's in everything.
I think Agar's a little too young in 32.
Oh, yes, he's 32. Anyway, okay, cut this whole section out because that bombed. Yeah. That was an idea that I thought we might go somewhere with.
Well, think about it, though. I said earlier that having that role be played by a very uncharismatic cat is a problem that plagues a lot of these pictures in that era, and that might be one of the reasons why we can't come up with anything.
Well, you know, because you're
better,
right, though, because it doesn't until you get to the 40s.
Yeah,
you know, the 40s are a lot of charismatic dudes, you know, showing up in these horror movies.
Hey, Dick Foran.
Dick Foran. Yeah. Okay.
Ooh, Dick Powell.
Dick Powell.
Dick Powell could. No, I'm dead serious.
Well, okay.
It's not the kind of role that Dick Powell was playing at the time, but it's the kind of role that Dick Powell would eventually prove he could play.
Yeah,
as he got older.
Okay.
Dick Powell. That's my vote.
All right. And Edward Van Sloan is the other doctor.
Oh no.
Yes.
No.
Okay, I'll take Edward Van Sloan back.
No, because now I got it. See.
Oh, okay. Hit me.
William Powell.
Oh, that's interesting. Is he the other doctor?
Yes.
Okay.
The two Powells. No relation.
They could Powell around a little bit. Wah, wah, wah.
No. Imagine what William Powell could have brought to that role, dude. Yeah. I mean, I'm typecasting a little bit because of the whole drunkard thing and the Thin Man and everything.
Yeah.
But still,
yeah.
Come on now. Come on.
Okay.
Work with me here.
I'm with you. I'm not denying you. I would never deny you. No, that'd be cool. Yeah.
But again, it's like that character doesn't have enough to do.
No, but what he does, it's one of those parts where the guy that's playing it does, he comes through.
Yeah.
He comes through with the role, with little things. You know, like one of the first things, you're a doctor, and he's like, whatever his line, like I used to be, or I guess you could say that. And the look on his face as he's delivering a line, it's like, yeah, you believe him. He's selling it. And he doesn't have a lot to do, but what he does have to do, he makes use of it. But he doesn't have a lot of charisma to bring it, to make you remember it that much.
The two Powells. I'm leaving this all in, by the way.
Okay, go ahead. Cut some of these spaces out, but...
You know. Yeah, I'm leaving it all in. You know why? Because if nobody likes it, I'll never know.
You told me not to go there, and you brought it right back around. Excellent.
I was saving it for myself.
So all in all, we give this two thumbs up, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we sort of crabbed about it some, but...
Yeah. We can pick anything to pieces. Now, come on.
Yeah. On a relative scale, I'd say it's very, very good.
Yeah. And I would watch it again anytime. And I think that's what it comes down to in a lot of these films. It's like, okay, you know, you watch one of these films, like, okay, I've seen it. I haven't seen it in a while. I just watched it. I don't need to see it again for a while. But this one, if we had time, if you wanted to watch it again now, I'd watch it again.
Well, I mean,
or watch it again tomorrow night. I mean,
there's,
you know.
There's the other side of it. We said it had a dreamy atmosphere, and it was legitimately creepy, and you can still get some of that creep feeling from it now. I mean, what more do you really want from a horror movie? Mission
exactly.
accomplished.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So, but I almost want to say that the reason we're judging it somewhat harshly for not quite being great is because it has the potential to be great.
Oh, it does.
Is that if it wasn't as good as it was, we wouldn't criticize it for not being great. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's the thing that annoys me the most about a lot of films, and especially a lot of ones today, too. But something that I like, and it just misses the mark. It's like, oh, man, the opportunity was right there, and they didn't take it. And I think you're exactly right on this one. It's a good film. It's a good, solid film. You get some scares, some shocking, a great look to it overall. But it's like it could be so much better. It's got the potential to just take off and go.
Right.
And it just doesn't quite do that. But it is enjoyable to watch. And I would watch it again anytime. And I still need to get that Blu-ray, that Criterion Blu-ray that you've got. I've got a old bootleg fan made DVD of it that I was watching.
Naughty, naughty.
That if you do want to see the fuzzy beast man again, I believe this DVD is a rip off the VHS that I've got.
The fuzzy beast man? Is that a euphemism?
It could be. Hey, you know, walking on all fours, whatever you said to begin. So with that said, I think we've have we come to the end?
Yeah.
I think I'm spent.
I think we beat this horse dead.
Yeah.
Rather than vivisected it and turn it into a man.
Ah, which we could have. We have that technology. We have got to hunt down Twilight People. If anybody out there has a copy of Twilight People, let me know. I want to see this film. Other than that, this should... Yeah, we're done. And the next episode, we haven't decided yet, have we?
No, we have not.
All right. It may be a very surprising next episode. We'll see. But
does that mean you have an idea, or will it be?
I have an idea.
Will it be surprising because it's surprising to us?
We have talked about it, you and I, but nothing is set in concrete. And it may happen. It may not. If it does, it's going to be an awesome episode
that
nobody else in the podcast land will have done one like this.
Right.
I don't think so. Then I could be wrong because I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, but. Keep paying attention to the Facebook page, whether you drop us a line or not, for info on the next episode, which could be really cool. And even if it's not really cool, it's still going to be really cool because we talk about cool shit.
We do talk about cool shit.
All right. I'm done.
Me too.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.